Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. The daily average number of new coronavirus cases in Massachusetts has been rising over the past few weeks, and the number of people being hospitalized for COVID-19 is rising too. The three-day average of COVID patients in Massachusetts hospitals is up 46% since hitting a low earlier this summer. This is all happening against the backdrop of confusing messaging from the president, who was released from the hospital yesterday while still being treated for the coronavirus and publicly pulled his mask off before going back into the White House. So here to give us some medical grounding is Dr. Helen Boucher, chief of the Division of Geographic Medicine and Infectious Diseases at Tufts Medical Center and a professor at the Tufts University School of Medicine. Dr. Boucher, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me, Tiziana. Nice to be with you.
Listeners, we'll take your calls here. What medical questions do you have about the progression of the pandemic in the Commonwealth? What questions do you have about our president's health or treatment? What do you want to know about the research on mask efficacy, maybe, or on treatment options for those with severe cases of COVID-19? Call 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also tweet us at Radio Boston. So, Dr. Boucher, let's start locally. The state tracks positivity rates, number of new cases, rate of hospitalization. It's all part of a dashboard. All the numbers are concerning. I wonder, as a physician, which of those do you follow most closely?
Well, you know, Tiziana, there's no one number that tells the whole story of what's happening with this epidemic. So we look at all the numbers on the dashboard and then even a little bit more, right? So the dashboard tells us what's happening across the state. It's also important to know what's happening in various communities. And we find out once a week, you know, which communities in our state are still in the red. And that's something that everyone should know about as well.
And that number is growing too.
Absolutely. So last week's report showed 24 municipalities across Massachusetts in the red, including Boston, which concerns us and it helps us to know where to direct efforts at testing and tracing and other measures to mitigate the spread of the virus.
What do you make of the fact that we've got more communities? You know, to get into the red, a community needs to show more than 8 cases per 100,000 people for a sustained 2-week period. What do you make of the fact that we have more communities going into the red?
Well, you know, in some ways this was not unexpected, right? We were watching this post-Labor Day time thinking that between the socialization that likely occurred around Labor Day and then the students coming back to colleges and universities and other schools that we might see some uptick. Of course, we don't want it to continue and we don't want to see more cities and towns getting into the red. So it's very important that we double down on the things we know work. That is covering our face when we're outside, washing our hands frequently, maintaining physical distance and avoiding crowds.
You mentioned college students coming back a second ago, and we're going to get into a little bit of math here. The state has changed the way it measures our positivity rate. Sorry about that. Basically, we used to look at the percentage of individuals testing positive. Now, we look at the percentage of positive tests, and that doesn't take into account college students, for example, who are getting tested multiple times per week. The new way we look at positivity has us at a 1.1% positivity rate. The old way has us at 3.6%, according to the Boston Globe in their analysis. 3.6 makes me very uncomfortable. It is not what the state is focusing on from a dashboard perspective now. How should we think about those two rates? Should we be following one versus the other? Do we need to know about both of them? Help us process that.
Yeah, no. So I think, as you point out, Tiziana, we need to look at both. And, you know, as we're doing more testing, interpreting the test positivity does become a little more complicated. So I think looking at it in both ways is useful. And again, it's important that we look at the variety of measures we have to help inform us. You mentioned incidence numbers. Those are very important. You know, all of these things together help inform us on where we are in the epidemic.
And listeners, we're going to keep talking with Dr. Boucher in a bit, start taking some of your calls with questions about the coronavirus in the Commonwealth right now, about safe mask practices, et cetera. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join that conversation. I know you know, Dr. Boucher, that While we have more states moving into the red, the governor has said that those states that are having the lowest risk of coronavirus spread or transfer can move on to the next part of phase three reopening. It changes how many people can be at inside performance venues, outdoor performance venues. Roller rinks, for example, can open now. Gyms can have a higher census inside the building. How do you feel about that choice?
Well, you know, it's important for us all to remember that the governor's, all of these inflection points are guided by data, and that the only communities that are being considered to go into part two of phase three are the communities who've been in the green for at least 3 weeks. So in these communities, the data do support this gradual reopening. And, you know, all of these decisions are made with the public health in mind, and that does include things like the economy and people's mental health. So it is true that the data do support in those communities this gradual reopening, and that it's also true that we need to keep an eye on how all these trends are moving.
I'm glad you noted communities as well. I think I said states by accident, but I meant communities within our state. You said something that I just immediately wanted to zero in on, Dr. Boucher. For months, I have been wondering about and anxious about the balance between preserving public health and preserving mental health. I know those are not either or, and yet we also know that we are seeing increases in things like depression, and that we're hearing lots of people talk about concerns, especially as the days get shorter, as the weather gets colder, as people will be more isolated because they can't be outside as much. How do we think about the mental health dimension of this?
Well, I think it's incumbent on all of us to think about that, right? To think about isolation. And, you know, that's why I choose the word physical distancing rather than social distancing. I think we have to be as creative as we can on ways to keep our social networks going and to keep supporting people in our lives who may be at risk of isolation and perhaps even worse. And it's going to take even more concerted efforts at our places of work and school and other places to really reach out and make sure that we're doing things both programmatically and individually to look out for people who might be at risk, because we do have likely, you know, several more months of this ahead of us.
Dr. Boucher, let's pick up a call. We have Eddie on the line, 1-800-423-8255 with your questions. Eddie's on the line from Burlington. Eddie, what's your question for Dr. Boucher?
My question is that if we spend so much time talking down Trump, and why don't we spend more time talking up Joe? Is there nothing to talk about there? Or?
Oh, I wasn't expecting that, Eddie. I thought you had a question about the medical dimension of things. I appreciate your call. We are actually, as Eddie says, going to talk about the president a bit now. I do want to do that because we are seeing messaging both from the president and now increasingly actually from the vice president, who's also a candidate for the office, Dr. Boucher, with some confusing information about the coronavirus. The president tweeted this morning, many people every year, sometimes over 100,000, and despite the vaccine, die from the flu. Are we going to close down our country? No, we have to learn to live with it, just like we are learning to live with COVID and most populations far less lethal, end quote. So that saying, less lethal than the flu, what does the data tell us about spread and lethality of the flu and of the coronavirus?
Right. So first and foremost, the coronavirus is highly infectious and highly contagious. And 90% of Americans have not been exposed to it. So we remain at risk from this infection. And sadly, it is highly lethal, especially in people with risk factors, including older age and underlying comorbidities. That is very different than what we see with influenza, which is a virus that has been around for decades and to which most of us have been exposed either through natural infection or vaccination, and most of us have some degree of immunity. There are deaths from influenza every year, but it is nowhere near along the magnitude of what we've been seeing from COVID-19. On an average year in the United States, we might see 36,000 deaths, 25 to 35 or 40,000 deaths from influenza. We are over 210,000 deaths in 8 months from COVID-19. So very, very different.
I do want to note that Twitter later hid the tweet for, quote, spreading misleading and potentially harmful information related to COVID-19, end quote, and Facebook removed it entirely. That raises a question. We are in a situation where the president is not providing straightforward information about public safety in this case. Where can people turn? And let me backtrack, because I've asked this question to our medical panels a number of times over the last several months, and I think it bears asking every time. In an era where, for a variety of reasons, public health has been politicized, we are in a general election right now, where is the most trustworthy and reliable information? Where can people turn to get the data that they need about what works, what they should do, et cetera?
Well, so very important. The national public health experts are at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, or the CDC. Locally, we have the Massachusetts Department of Public Health, who are outstanding. We have people in the infectious diseases and other medical communities who are spending our time trying to share information as truthfully and straightforwardly as possible. We also have resources like the Infectious Diseases Society of America at idsociety.org, where there's great information about things like treatment, as you mentioned, Tiziana. But we should be letting the public health experts be the public health experts, no matter what, to keep the information flowing freely and honestly.
You just mentioned treatment. I want to talk about that for a minute. Dr. Boucher, you specialize in infectious disease. We know the president has been receiving a steroid, an antiviral medication, and an experimental drug cocktail. He's also received supplemental oxygen. Is it common for someone experiencing symptoms of COVID-19 to receive all of those things?
Well, Tiziana, in patients with COVID who are sick enough to come to the hospital and you have hypoxia or low oxygenation, it is not uncommon for them to require or to be treated with more than one form of treatment at a time. For example, dexamethasone and remdesivir, as you mentioned. The monoclonal antibody cocktail is not either authorized or approved for treatment. It's only available in clinical trials. So it would have to be administered in that kind of a setting.
So in the Commonwealth right now, under what circumstances could someone expect to be admitted to the hospital if they have the coronavirus?
So again, in general, patients who are sick enough where they can't eat and drink, where they're having trouble breathing, where their oxygen is low, those would all be the types of indications for admission to the hospital that we would see with COVID.
And is there currently hospital capacity for anyone or everyone who is experiencing those symptoms? You know, of course, that we heard frightening stories during the peak of our infection back in the April timeframe about whether or not there would be hospital capacity for everybody.
Right. Well, the good news is, Tiziana, that we are in very good shape in terms of capacity, right? So if we look at that state dashboard, as of yesterday, there were only 3 hospitals operating anywhere near capacity. So we have lots of hospital beds and ICU beds available. What we're seeing now is that the infections are largely happening in younger individuals, and it may be that those younger individuals don't get sick enough to require hospitalization, or that they have enough time hasn't passed for them to require hospitalization. But we know from data across the country that the overall treatment of COVID has improved. And so that's a good thing, and that bodes well for people doing better. And so again, the message is that right now we're in very good shape in Massachusetts with capacity in our hospitals.
Does that mean that the fatality rate is also decreasing?
Well, you know, we don't know that yet. So I think all we can talk about is what we see in terms of deaths reported. But, you know, we're in the 8th/9th month of this epidemic. And so it's really hard to talk about fatality rate with any certainty this early on. So I would hesitate to make any conjectures on that.
Let's pick up another call here. We've got Dave on the line from Westwood. Dave, what's your question?
Doctor, when does this end, and what does the end look like, and how do we get there? I mean, I think we know how to get there, although I watched the vice president last night in between timeouts. He didn't really say how we get there. He just met more of the same, it sounds like. But seriously, what does the end look like, and how do we get there, and when do we get there? This open-endedness of all this just seems to be the worst part of it all.
Yeah,
Dave, well, thank you for that. And just Dr. Boucher, just for our listeners, I think Dave's saying that he was watching Joe Biden on the town hall in between timeouts of the Patriots game last night, just to give people some context there. Dr. Boucher, go ahead.
Sure. So, you know, I share your exhaustion and frustration, right? We're all tired and exhausted and wondering, you know, when this will end. I mean, we know that all epidemics end. So that's the good news. What does it look like? I think it's going to look like a combination of improved therapies and a vaccine. I think we're going to see therapies perhaps like these monoclonal antibody cocktails, along with perhaps some other drugs, in addition to the remdesivir and dexamethasone that we have. Better testing, more available testing, and a vaccine. All of those things coming together over the next 6 to 9 to maybe 12 months to get us through to the end of this.
I want to note, too, that Dave's call was serious and his anxiety was real. I was using a happy voice because it was fun to know that he and I had the same viewing habits last night. But, you know, what he's asking is serious. And I remember, Dr. Boucher, one of the moments that hit me the hardest was covering a presser with Governor Charlie Baker where he referred to mask usage as the new normal. Is that one of the permanent behavior changes we are likely to see or not? And are there other permanent behavior changes you think we're going to see?
Well, you know, it's a great question. And I think that we in the infectious disease community have also referred to mask wearing as a new normal and physical distancing as a bit of a new normal. I hope it's a temporary normal. I hope it's a year or year and a half before we can be able to hug our friends and, you know, have the social interactions that we used to have. But I think it will be some time, because even with those medicines, improved testing, and a vaccine, it will take months before we have enough people protected to where we could safely interact in the ways that we used to.
Let's talk about those medicines again for a minute. And you already referenced the fact that the monoclonal antibody cocktail made by Regeneron is not something that's regularly in use. But dexamethasone, remdesivir, things that the president received, if somebody in the Commonwealth or in one of the other New England states, maybe that doesn't have as many major medical centers, is in the hospital, is that full range of treatments available to them? And how dependent is that on their health care insurance?
Good question. I mean, I think in the good news department, dexamethasone is very cheap, on the order of $1 a day. Remdesivir is, you know, a little bit more expensive, like $150 a day or so, I believe. And it has been distributed across the country. So these medicines should be available to Americans who need it. And I very much hope that would be, you know, regardless of their insurance situation. We know that in the setting of COVID, testing and other measures have been offered to everybody. And so my hope is that there will not be those barriers to getting those treatments.
So the kind of treatment that the president received at Walter Reed Military Medical Center, is it more than people in the Commonwealth can receive, or is it simply, was it more intensified because he is the president? You know, one of the narratives that we've seen is the president is telling people not to be afraid of COVID, but he's getting an exceptional level of health care. Can you comb that out for us?
Well, I have to be a little bit careful because I don't know the details of his care because I'm not his physician. But I very much hope that everyone in the Commonwealth who comes to the hospital gets the best level of care that we can deliver. That includes intensive care, oxygen, drugs like remdesivir and dexamethasone that they need, and care by physicians, nurses, respiratory therapists, and others who are fully competent to provide that care. So I have no reason to believe that there should be any barrier to people in our Commonwealth receiving that care. The one thing that you and I cannot obtain would be the drug, the monoclonal antibody cocktail, outside the setting of a clinical trial.
Well, Dr. Helen Boucher, Chief of the Division of Geographic Medicine and Infectious Diseases at Tufts Medical Center and professor at the Tufts University School of Medicine, you've been generous with your time. Thank you so much for coming on and giving us some perspective, some facts, and answering our questions.
Thanks for having me, Tiziana.
It was great to have you. In the wake of President Trump's coronavirus diagnosis, Americans have diverged on whether to have empathy for the president and have struggled for the right response. Reverend Laura Everett, who is the executive director of the Massachusetts Council of Churches, recently wrote an op-ed for Cognoscenti, which is WBUR's ideas and opinion page. It was called, "I'm Praying for Donald Trump, Even Though I Don't Want To." In it, Everett explains how praying for the president isn't about who he is, but about who she wants to be. To talk about it, Reverend Laura Everett joins us now. Reverend Laura, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Hi, Tiziana.
So when did you begin praying and what was your first prayer?
Oh, my stomach dropped when I heard the news. And this was a real challenge. This was a real challenge for me. I imagine it was for many people. I've been praying for so many people who have been sick. I've done funerals for those who have died. And, you know, my wall is littered with, not littered, my wall is papered with the names of people who I hold in prayer right now. And it pained me, but it felt important to add the names of the people who had contracted COVID at this event at the White House.
You talked about it being painful, and we're going to talk now about your spiritual journey. And I want to acknowledge that. I want to take a second here, Reverend Laura, to say we are in a general election. Voting has started in some parts of the country. There will be listeners who disagree with how you feel about the president, who disagree with the choice to pray, who think it's a no-brainer. Of course you would pray. This is our conversation about your spiritual journey from where you are. Why did you want to write a piece and tell the world that you were praying for someone that you didn't want to be praying for?
Right. Well, and I've heard from a lot of those people, people who are angry with me for praying for him, and people who are angry with me that I'm praying for him with what is they perceived as an asterisk. But it felt important to me also because I don't think we often see religious leaders grapple in public with their struggles to live according to their values and according to their traditions. But it seemed important to me to share with other people how hard I think this is. And as a Christian, as a public leader in the church, this is one of the places where I find it incredibly hard to follow Jesus. The words are pretty clear here about loving your enemies and praying for those who persecute you. The gospel is so inconvenient for me right here. And Mr. Trump claims to follow this migrant, brown-skinned Jewish rabbi named Jesus, just as I do. And the gospel asks of me things I'd rather not do. I do not especially want to pray for my enemies. But here I am, and here is this person who was also baptized, who also makes a claim to be a Christian, and I hear Jesus, who I say is my Savior and Lord, asking me to do something I'd rather not do, in part because the president has made decisions again and again and again that put people I love and communities that are fragile because of his decisions in danger. I am so angry. I'm so angry with this man's behavior that has led to death and destruction.
So it's interesting. I mean, you use the term enemy to refer to the president of the United States, and you're expressing a great deal of anger. And again, in a world where I know that you know that not everyone, not even every Christian, sees it that way. There are huge swaths of Christian America who would disagree with you on almost everything you just said. As a pastor, somebody who has chosen to live your personal and professional life in the Christian faith, how do you work through that?
Hopefully with a fair amount of humility, knowing that there are places where I may be wrong and I need other people to correct me. Also with time in silence and in prayer before God and in serious contemplation of both the words of Scripture and the traditions that I uphold. And I understand that this is an incredibly hard call to pray for those with whom you disagree, to pray for those who are making decisions that are hurting people you love. You know, this past weekend, Tiziana, I presided at a funeral for a family where we withheld hugs. We didn't sing together. We withheld acts of compassion in order to keep one another safe. That's what I did this weekend in order to protect people I love. And meanwhile, what does the president do? He goes on a joyride and puts staff at risk. He refuses to wear a mask, and he proceeds to spread false information about this illness, all the while receiving the best medical treatment in the nation. It is, as I have been working for the past 7 months to make sure Christians in the Commonwealth are being as safe as we can be, to not create super spreader events at church, I find this absolutely infuriating. And I hear the gospel ask me to pray. And so I'm trying to hold that complexity.
Let's take one step to the left out of the portion of our conversation that is at root about a Christian message here. And let's talk about, for just a minute, as a pastor, how you think about talking to people about the relationship between anger and empathy.
I think feelings are valid. I think feelings are very, very valid. And, you know, the great thing for me about the fullness of Scripture is that we get such a wide range of feelings. We get psalms with anger and rage, and those are also part of the tradition. I want to be really careful. Go ahead.
No. Go ahead. I want to hear this.
Sure. I want to be really careful. I'm saying what is true for me right now. That I have some capacity to pray. And I understand that not everybody is in this place. I know there have been times when I've been too angry, too heartsick, too weary to pray, and other people have held prayers for me. And maybe I can do that for other people right now, too.
We have about 30 seconds left, Reverend Laura. What is a prayer that you are saying for our broader Commonwealth community during this crisis?
I'm praying for healing. I am praying for healing. I've been praying a prayer since fairly early on, asking that this plague pass over, because God's will is health and wholeness, and God longs for us to be one. Let this plague pass over, for your will is health and wholeness, and you long for us to be one.
And that is Reverend Laura Everett, Executive Director of the Massachusetts Council of Churches. You can find a link to her op-ed on our website, radioboston.org. Thank you.
Thank you, Tiziana.
As the pandemic continues to disrupt our lives, we all long to return to familiar things we love. And for some students, that means playing sports again. But what's it like to play sports here in the time of COVID, especially competitive high school sports? Well, to find out, we caught up with Needham High School girls soccer coach Carl Tarabelli. He told us that despite changes to the rules, the league being broken into pods, even a lack of playoffs this year, whatever it takes to get the kids back on the field is worth it.
Our goal really is not the league standings and the competition so much as it is just having the opportunity to get the kids out every day, you know, 3:15 to 5:15, provide them a structure, safe environment that gives them some sense of normalcy. So, you know, we've been at it 2 weeks now, and it's like a breath of fresh air. You know, the girls come down to the field. We have all sorts of protocols. The first one that's most visible is they have to wear masks all the time. And, you know, that clearly, from a CDC standpoint and everything else, makes perfect sense. We actually, you know, we don't have a locker room. So, like in our facility at our field, we have a little hill, and we actually painted 10-foot dots because they just go to a dot with their gear, and they plop down, and that's their area for when they need a water break, when they, you know, have to go to their bag to get equipment or anything else like that. So from that standpoint, they own their dot, you know, and they get a kick out of that.
So that's one change. But now we also know that there have been just a ton of rule changes for all fall sports this year, including soccer. Tell us a little bit about some of the more challenging rule changes for soccer this year, Carl.
So the rule changes, you know, aside from the masks, I personally understand it. And I really appreciate what, you know, that represents. You know, the Department of the Environmental and Energy from the state standpoint has come down with a mandated phased approach. And then from there, MISA and MIA and the governing bodies of different, you know, organizations, our case MIA, has come up with these rule changes. And the rule changes are challenging, but again, the kids just want to play. So, you know, we're not allowed to head the ball. We're not allowed to throw the ball in. We're not allowed to kick the ball in the air on restarts. We're not allowed to physically touch, deliberately engage in touching.
Sounds hard. I mean, can it work?
It's not the game, and so it's just an opportunity for the kids to try and play and adapt. We actually had a referee come and do one of our scrimmages so we could see and deal with it firsthand. And, you know, the kids trying to figure out what works and what doesn't work. It'll be interesting to see in a live game how rules are interpreted. But, you know, from the standpoint of the rules that have been handed down that change the game and not make the game soccer, you know, it is what it is, and we're dealing with it.
How are the girls feeling about it, Carl?
I think the fact that they're out and about and playing and with their friends overrides everything, and the fact that there's no conference titles, no standings, they just don't care. They want to play, and they're going to adapt, and they're going to play, and they're going to have fun. You know, as a high school coach, I've got 5 seniors on my team, and my goal is to make the games as memorable and as meaningful for my 5 seniors. But I think they'll be frustrated, you know, to a degree if inadvertent touching represents penalties and the game is constantly stopping. So, you know, we'll figure it out.
Did that happen in the scrimmage, Carl? Did that happen that you said you had a referee come out to one of your scrimmages? Was there a lot of challenge with trying not to touch each other or break these other rules?
There was definitely challenges. So it's how refs interpret, and the guidelines are such that, you know, in soccer, you don't deliberately try and engage physically. That's a penalty. You know, it's not like you're in football and you're on the line and you're trying to hit each other. But, you know, if 2 players are shoulder to shoulder going after the same ball, I don't know how a ref's going to call that, in that who's the actual one you're going to penalize. They're both going shoulder to shoulder running after a 50-50 ball.
Do you have any concern that the season, despite these frustrating, but it sounds like, you know, sort of very clear new guidelines for how you and the girls play the game, do you have any concern that the season might get canceled partway through? And what would that mean for your players, especially your seniors, if that happened?
Absolutely. Every day we check the day off, and it's as if it's our last day. Because as I've explained to these kids and to their parents, there are so many factors that are out of their control that could shut us down. And so, you know, the fact that we've got 2 weeks under our belt, that's 2 weeks more than I thought we would have. And if we get 5 more weeks, that's going to be tremendous. Because, you know, even in our little pod, for instance, Natick is under a 2-week quarantine because of an incident in Natick a week ago. There was a party, and the superintendent shut down everything related to athletics, even though none of the athletes on the girls' soccer program were identified. But the fact that they couldn't trace, so Natick is missing 2 out of its 8 games. And thankfully, we play them after their 2-week quarantine, so we're not going to lose out on that. But Natick, you know, unfortunately, you know, was dealt a hand, and now instead of 8 games, they only have 6, and they've lost 2 weeks of activity. We have other towns like Framingham that went red, and they're shut down, period. So it's every day is we're thankful to have an opportunity to be out there. You know, it's the safest 2 hours of their day. They're out. They're within a controlled environment. They're social distancing. They're wearing masks. They have their own ball. They have their own pennies. There's no sharing of equipment. Being outside in an open area, I tell parents this is the best opportunity for them and it's the safest 2 hours of their day.
What about members in the community who think sports shouldn't be happening at all right now?
Well, quite honestly, I feel sorry for them because they have lost the sight of what athletics represents, especially at a high school level. And, you know, you need healthy minds. You need healthy bodies. They're not putting anybody at risk when they're on a field and spread out. And, you know, they're not putting anyone else in any kind of danger. A lot of what we're providing these kids right now is more mental than it is physical. These kids have had their lives flipped upside down since last March. A lot of them lost their spring seasons, their multi-sport athletes. Athletics is really a co-curricular activity with academics at the high school level. It's not college where kids have been recruited and they're going to college, you know, to play a sport. It's certainly not professional. You know, athletics represents social interaction that's safe. It's mental, you know, stimulation. It allows them, you know, to have exercise. So I think people who think athletics should be shut down, I think they're just lost, and I feel bad for them.
And what is your biggest hope for student-athletes across the Commonwealth right now?
Right now, normalcy. This has to represent some sense of normalcy. The fact that they know after school, whether it's remote, whether it's hybrid, whether it's, you know, in school, that they have a structure that they've always had. They can go down to the field after school, be with their friends, train, turn off all the craziness that's been surrounding them for at least 2 hours, and let them be kids again. That's the most important thing.
And that's Carl Tarabelli, coach of the Needham High School varsity girls soccer team. Carl, I appreciate you taking some time to talk with us.
Thanks for that opportunity. I appreciate it.
And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Zoe Mitchell, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, and Walter Wolfman. Engineering today is by Jimmy Kiesling. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.